He was the old man of his division, but on runs he was always near the front of the pack, right there with the recent high school graduates. Adam never took the yelling and berating from the recruit division commander personally, unlike many of the younger guys who felt the full stinging disparagement of these verbal beatdowns. Being Adam, he'd wait for opportune moments to build his fellow recruits back up, demonstrating the leadership that had been MIA all those years. On October 16th, Kelly, Larry, Janice, and Heath Vance gathered at the Naval Service Training Command Center to watch Adam, who had been named honor recruit of his division, graduate. The whole world got a little brighter for the Brown family that day, especially when the commanding officer read aloud from his commendation letter to Adam. By virtue of your demonstrated attention to duty, military conduct, responsiveness to orders, cooperation, loyalty, and comradeship, you have been selected by your shipmates as honor recruit for Division 401. I take great pleasure in commending you for your fine performance, which has earned you the admiration and respect of your shipmates, and extend to you a well done for your impressive achievement.
I love you, Adam, Kelly told her husband when she finally got the chance to wrap her arms around him. I'm so proud of you.
When Adam carried Kelly over the threshold of the on-base apartment, secured for them by Captain Bushman and their first home as newlyweds, she was 22, and he was 24. A few days after graduation, as the couple settled into the military community of Naval Station Great Lakes, Adam made some phone calls. The first was to Captain Bushman.
Thank you for believing in me, sir, he said.
I had no doubts, said Captain Bushman.
None.
Adam called Kelly's father, then Richard Williams, and his father, Curtis Williams, as well as Ryan Whited, Grandma Brown, and of course, Manda, whose tough love approach had been the softest. She had rarely distanced herself from Adam, and now she congratulated her brother and thanked Kelly for the unconditional love she had shown him. But a call to Sean, Adam's original hero and moral mentor, meant the most. Even though they had put the past behind them, Sean had remained understandably skeptical throughout Adam's attempts at sobriety and had withheld any accolades. Until now.
Mom and Dad are so proud of you, he said, and so am I.
The praise Adam received from his family was like rocket fuel as he headed into an intense blur of classes and field work for the next 6 months. On the first day of A school, the coffee maker began brewing a few minutes before Kelly and Adam's alarm clock went off at 4 a.m. She made him breakfast, then hopped back into bed while he hurried off to seal PT, what would become their routine each weekday. At 5 a.m. every morning, some 150 prospective SEALs would queue up outside on a slab of concrete the size of a basketball court, or in the gym if there was a blizzard, or at the pool on swim days. Standing atop a small wooden block, the motivator was an active duty SEAL whose goal was to physically prepare these boot camp graduates for the wet and sandy hell of BUDS. A couple of hours a day, a few days a week is not enough time to prepare you for what I promise will be the longest 27 weeks of your life, yelled the motivator. What we'll be doing here is fun. If you're not having fun, you're in the wrong place. Better go and pick out a ship. 'Cause that's where you're heading. The temperature, like the original number of 150 men, dropped significantly as fall merged into winter. 2 mile runs in the rain became 5 mile runs in hail and then 8 mile runs in snow, as the Great Lakes region dished out storm after storm, rivaled in intensity by whatever the motivator could concoct for that day's session after the run. It might be an hour-long crab walk, 500 push-ups, or a buddy carry through deep snow. On one particularly miserable morning, the motivator decided the students should do nothing but sit-ups for an entire hour, with a goal of 1,000. No one but the motivator could actually do that many, but they grunted and jerked their bodies through the motions till their backs were bleeding. Then there was swimming. Miles and miles of swimming. Sometimes underwater. Sometimes with fins, sometimes with clothes on, other times with rocks in their pockets. Just a little taste of what you'll face at BUDS, said the motivator.
After the two-hour PT, Adam would rush home, his lips blue and his cheeks red and windburned, but with a smile on his face.
"I can't wait for San Diego," he'd say to Kelly,
not a doubt in his mind that that was where they were heading. He would take a quick shower, change into the uniform of the day, and find a full breakfast waiting for him that he'd gobble down before running to his A-school classes at 8 a.m. Kelly would walk Sydney, then head off to her job at the base travel agency. Dinner was ready or in the oven when he got home by 6 that evening. Then he would study, Kelly quizzing him with flashcards.
"I babied him," said Kelly, who finished each night by drawing Adam a hot bath complete with mountains of bubbles, just the way he liked it. "I wanted to give him every advantage because I knew, with that drug calling his name, he was fighting something none of the other guys were. 'Stay in bed, it's cold and dark,' he'd tell me when he got up. He never took it for granted. We were broke, but he treated me like a princess. Every day he'd tell me how pretty I was or how lucky he was. We saved our change in a bucket, and on weekends we went to the MWR, the base's Morale, Welfare, and Recreation Center, and had Pac-Man wars for hours till our quarters ran out. When he wasn't at school and I wasn't at work, we were attached at the hip. A-school was our honeymoon."
On April 6, 1999, Adam, one of only a few dozen students who had stuck it out through SEAL PT, was chosen as a distinguished military graduate from the A-school course. His commanding officer praised him in his commendation letter. "Exemplary performance in military decorum, appearance, respect for authority, and leadership in your peer group in addition to your outstanding academic record. These achievements are significant and have distinguished you as a top performer and team player. This superb performance demonstrates your self-motivation and sets an outstanding example for your peers. You are encouraged to sustain this level of performance. Not only will you benefit from it, your example will encourage others to carry out their duties in the proud traditions of the Naval Service." Kelly was ecstatic when she read the letter.
"You're on a roll, baby. Remember where you came from and look where you are. You need to call your parents. Good job."
Kelly and Adam drove across country in a big Ryder truck, her Pontiac Grand Am parked inside the back, surrounded by boxes, and Sydney in the cab with them. Each day brought them closer to the home they'd rented online in the town of El Cajon, 20 miles northeast of Coronado Island. Each state line they crossed brought Adam nearer to 27 weeks of the most torturous military training ever devised. At the same time, former SEAL Dick Couch was gaining clearance from the Navy to observe and document what Adam was about to undergo. "A process," he would write in the Warrior Elite, "that transforms young men into warriors, a distillation of the human spirit, a tradition-bound ordeal that seeks to find men with character, courage, and the burning desire to win at all costs, men who would rather die than quit." Adam wore his dress whites when he checked in at the Naval Special Warfare Center on the Naval Amphibious Base in Coronado, California, at the beginning of May, one of 145 men in SEAL Class 226. The class proctor outlined the course and told them that only 20% of them would remain at graduation. He explained the DOR, drop-on-request, option that any of them could use at any time, a get-out-of-hell-free card where one need only ring a bell, a public announcement that said, "I'm not good enough to be a Navy SEAL. The reputation you forge here will follow you to the teams," the proctor said. "Your reputation here will define you." "Hoo-yah!" was the response. And so began the punishing rite of passage. Most candidates admit being a little awestruck and a tad intimidated when they first encounter the jaw-dropping male specimens who show up for buds to strut their stuff. Then there was Adam. "He was nothing special," says Christian Taylor, at 29, one of the few guys older than Adam. Christian was not going to ring that bell, and he made it again to predict who would. "I didn't take him seriously," Christian continues. "That southern accent and all, he seemed too friendly to be tough. But boot camp and A-school had awakened in Adam the psycho who never quit. On top of that, as he told Kelly many times, his ace in the hole was his faith, which gave him a refuge to go to and a shield of strength. Quoting the verse Pastor Smith had shared with him in jail, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Philippians 4:13. He said he had complete confidence, not in himself, but in the one who lived within him. If innate mental and physical toughness was his armor and faith his ace in the hole, Kelly was Adam's secret weapon. As he began the first phase of Bud's, Kelly charged into her own grueling routine. Once again, she'd found a job at a travel agency, and every day at 5 p.m., she'd get off work and hurry home to take Sydney for a quick walk before driving the half hour to the Bud's compound. Arriving around 6, she'd park and read her Bible or another book until Adam showed up, anywhere from 6 to 10. Perhaps his boat team, or even the entire class, had been pegged by the instructors as requiring some extra motivation in the form of a 4-mile run, some log PT, or an hour of push-ups and sit-ups. Occasionally, she'd pick him up as late as midnight if there'd been a night-specific exercise. While Kelly drove, Adam would strip off his wet, sandy camis and T-shirt. At home, he'd hose off outside, then jump in the shower while she shook the sand out of his clothes and tossed them in the washer. She'd make dinner, and he'd practically fall asleep in his food before flopping into bed, already snoring when she put his clothes in the dryer, then boxed his cover, shaped and creased his hat, and, if it was a scheduled inspection day, shined his boots, touched up the paint on his helmet, and polished it, and starched and ironed his camouflage uniform. Only after laying out his boots, and still warm from the dryer PT clothes, long pants, T-shirt, and socks, would she crawl into bed next to him. At 3:30 a.m., Kelly would rise and make a breakfast of scrambled eggs, toast, and bacon or ham, and wake Adam up at 3:45 with a cup of coffee. He'd wolf down the food, pull his clothes on, and they'd be on the road by 4, Adam snoozing with his head on Kelly's shoulder. She'd wake him up when they arrived at the gate between 4:30 and 4:45, and he'd push her nose like a button, kiss her on the lips and forehead, and say, Bye, itty bitty. He'd drop off his duffel of sparkling clean clothes in his room, everyone was assigned a room, even those who lived off base, and line up on the concrete meeting area called the Grinder, ready for PT at 5 a.m. By the time Kelly was back on the freeway heading east, Adam was already either sweating from a combination of push-ups, sit-ups, dips, and pull-ups, wet and cold from a trip into the Pacific, or enduring being a sugar cookie, jumping into the ocean, and then rolling around in the sand. After running anywhere from 2 to 6 miles, he'd eat a second breakfast with the single guys who stayed on base. You cannot eat enough, is a Bud's instructor's mantra. It's impossible to replace the calories burned on a daily basis. Unable to go back to sleep, Kelly would spend the hours before going to work prepping for dinner, cleaning the house, and taking Sydney for a longer walk. Weekends were recovery for both Adam and Kelly. On Saturdays, they'd sleep in late and watch movies, and on Sundays, they'd regain their spiritual strength for the upcoming week by attending church. Kelly came home for lunch one day, after 3 weeks of this schedule, feeling unusually exhausted. She sat on the couch, closed her eyes, and woke up after an hour. In the past, she couldn't nap if she tried. But the following day, the same thing happened. Maybe you're pregnant, a co-worker suggested. No, said Kelly. Of course not. But after dropping Adam off the next morning, she bought a pregnancy test at a pharmacy and rushed home to take it. Positive.
Oh, Lord, she said aloud. Really?
Returning to the pharmacy, she bought 2 more tests. Both were positive.
Right now? Right at the start of Bud's? She thought.
Beyond the shocking reality of impending parenthood, she was worried about putting Adam into a tailspin.
Okay, how am I going to tell him? She asked herself.
That evening, she didn't say a word about the pregnancy during the drive, just got Adam home and put him in a bubble bath. Then she sent Sydney into the bathroom. Her collar hooked up to a balloon that read in big letters, "Congratulations, you're having a baby." Standing outside the door, Kelly waited for a reaction, but none came. Finally, she walked in, saw that Adam hadn't noticed the dog or the balloon, and handed him a small plastic stick.
"Honey," he said, "I'm fine. I feel fine."
"No, no, no," said Kelly. "It's not a thermometer. See this?"
She pointed to the pink line, and then the balloon, and said,
"It's a pregnancy test, baby. I'm pregnant."
They stared at each other for a minute or more.
"Okay.
This just makes it even more important," said Adam. "I have to get through, Buds." Chapter 9. Pays to be a Winner. As a new father-to-be, Adam tackled the gauntlet head first. On his boat team, he chose the front left paddling position, next to Christian on front right, arguably the two toughest positions. Together they dug deep with their oars, first to crash through the cresting waves that broke over them as they paddled out through the surf, racing the other boat teams and battling painful ice cream headaches brought on by water temperatures in the high 50s. During the long, rigorous paddle, his boat crew would try to rotate out with him, but Adam routinely refused.
"I got it,"
he'd say in that deep Arkansas twang, says Christian. I would get so mad because if he wasn't going to switch, I wasn't going to switch. And I was getting smoked. He could suck it up more than anybody. Competitively, Adam was my nemesis. I'd push it as hard as I could, and we were neck and neck running, neck and neck on the obstacle course, same with swimming, and it just annoyed me. In surf torture, they'd make us lie down and link arms in the sand, freezing cold waves splashing over us, our teeth chattering like we're running a jackhammer, and I'd look over at Adam next to me, and he was blue from the cold and grinning, like he was loving it. I remember thinking, what is driving this guy? With Hell Week about to begin, Adam stood before the performance review board. He had passed the 50-meter underwater swim, underwater knot-tying test, and drown-proofing test. He had finished the 1,200-meter pool swim with fins in under 45 minutes, 1 mile bay swim with fins in under 50 minutes, 1 mile ocean swim with fins in under 50 minutes, 1.5 mile ocean swim with fins in less than 70 minutes, 2 mile ocean swim with fins in under 95 minutes, obstacle course in less than 15 minutes, and 4 mile run in boots and pants in less than 32 minutes. But he needed to work on his swimming times, the review board told him. He'd barely made the 2 mile ocean swim within the 95-minute time constraint, and the next 2 mile swim had to be finished within 85 minutes, with the final 2 mile swim in phase 3 in under 75 minutes. The fact that the board was coaching Adam, not reprimanding him, meant the instructors liked him. He had continually exhibited the teamwork and can-do attitude they were looking for. 98 students entered Hell Week. 5 days of relentless, round-the-clock physical and mental hazing, with only 4 to 5 hours of sleep the entire time. At its end, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura made a guest appearance, calling out the ceremonial, "Hell Week is secured!" To Adam, Christian, and the 63 other students who remained. Ventura, whose real name is James Janus, had graduated from Buds, Class 58, in 1970, and served during the Vietnam era on Underwater Demolition Team, UDT, 12. He shook hands with the men and told them they were one step closer to being part of the greatest fraternity in the world. "Don't give up," he said. Later, the soft-spoken base chaplain, Bob Freiberg, gave a personalized Bible to each of the 65, letting them know that they didn't have to read it or even keep it. After thanking the chaplain, Adam opened the book and read the inscription. ICFN Brown. Congrats on completing Hell Week, 25th to 30th July, 1999. Class 226. God bless. Chaplain Freiberg. Adam knew exactly what he was going to do with his camouflage-covered Bible, but first, he had to make it through the rest of Buds. "You're beautiful," was the first thing Adam said to Kelly as he stumbled to the car, the first time he'd seen her since the start of Hell Week.
"You're delirious," she said with a laugh. "How you feeling?"
"I'm just fine. How are you feeling? Everything okay? How's our little baby?" He rubbed Kelly's belly, which didn't yet show any sign of being pregnant, and she said,
"Hungry."
"Me too," he said. "Let's eat." Adam was asleep before they reached the freeway, and at home Kelly got him bathed, fed, and into bed, where he slept for another 15 hours.
"I have to cut 10 minutes off my time or it's done," he said to her as soon as he awoke, referring to the 2-mile ocean swim. "I'll get rolled, or they'll drop me."
A student who couldn't pass all the requirements could be dropped completely from the course or, if instructors saw potential, rolled into the following course during any of the 3 phases of BUDS. This meant that if Adam couldn't pass the 2-mile ocean swim, the instructors could roll him into class 227 at phase 2. While waiting for his new class to get to the second phase, which would take about 2 months, he would have to maintain his fitness level and assist the instructors. He had 3 weeks to improve his time, and he knew he'd already given his all just to make the 95-minute cutoff. With rigorous training, he had improved his strokes and bettered his time by the final week of phase 1, but not by enough. "I got a call from Adam before this big open ocean swim, and he asked us to pray for him," remembers Larry. "We had the whole church praying for him on that day. I was at a men's prayer breakfast when a friend, Ted Smithers, prayed aloud that Adam would not only qualify, he would beat his best time by so much that it would be evident to everyone that God did it, not Adam." On the crucial day, Adam came in at under 75 minutes. He not only cut 20 minutes off his prior best time, he also beat the required time by a full 10 minutes. The second phase of BUDS, dive phase, is considered by many to be as difficult as Hell Week. In pool competency, students must perform specific tasks underwater, sometimes with mask, fins, and dive gear, sometimes without, displaying perfect technical procedures without panic while being harassed to the point of near drowning by the instructors. It is not uncommon for an unconscious student to be hauled out of the pool vomiting water. This was most often the case with mentally tough students like Adam who wouldn't give up, students who would rather die than quit. But no matter how much he tried, Adam could not pass pool comp. And when the review board informed him that he would be rolled to the dive phase of the next class rather than dropped, he was both angry with himself and relieved. He also added up the months in his head. Class 227 would finish very near Kelly's due date. 12 students were rolled during pool comp, including Christian, medically rolled for stress fractures in one of his legs. Also rolled was a fellow student 5 years younger than Adam named Austin Michaels, one of the single guys whom Adam and Kelly invited over for home-cooked meals on weekends. When Adam said grace before dinner one night, Austin realized that they shared the same religious beliefs, and he was stunned when Adam confided in him about the dark times he and Kelly had gone through. From that point forward, the Browns and Austin were family. Adam and Austin began the second phase of BUDS for a second time with SEAL Class 227. Christian Taylor was also on the roster and ready to go, his fractures now healed. "You again," said Christian when he saw Adam, only half joking. A couple of weeks later, Christian and Adam were facing each other in the ice bath, teeth chattering and lips turning blue, after getting in trouble for putting away their dive gear before the instructor told them to. The ice bath was a trough of freezing cold water, affectionately referred to as a slushy by instructors who used it as a motivational tool. After adding a pitcher of ice cubes to the water Adam and Christian were sitting in, their steel-faced instructor said, "The only way you are getting out of this slushy is to make me laugh. One of you better have a joke or something that is going to make me laugh." He dumped another pitcher of ice into the trough, crossed his arms, and stood over them like an emotionless robot. Shivering violently, Adam said,
"Hoo-yah, instructor! I have one for y'all."
Class 227 gathered around while Adam relayed a story that had been infamous at Lake Hamilton High, an embarrassing incident at a party that happened to a buddy and the buddy's girlfriend, both of whom drank too much and suffered food poisoning. For full effect, Adam told the self-deprecating story detail by detail, as though it had happened to him. The account included meticulous descriptions of bodily functions occurring simultaneously, to the horror of the poor fellow's girlfriend, who had a front-row seat to it all. By the end, the instructor was laughing so hard that Adam and Christian could barely make out his words. "Pays to be a winner, Brown." Which meant they could get out of the ice bath. While cold, wet, sandy is the theme for Buds, pays to be a winner is the mantra of instructors who demand teamwork. Anybody who hasn't pulled his weight is long gone by phase two, yet also create competition by offering rewards, usually rest, to those who finish first. The winning boat team on a course out through the surf, around a buoy, and back to the beach, gets to lounge in the sand while the other boat teams do it again. A poor result on the obstacle course might find an individual running it again that night while the rest of the class eats dinner. Instructors know that every student is exhausted, but winners prove they can dig deep when they're at their breaking point, finding that something extra when their bodies tell them nothing is left. Adam was known among the instructors for two reasons. His wife was expecting a baby, and he was one of only a few throughout the course who never once failed to give his all, and then some. His scores were not the highest, but his determination was unmatched, and that carried him into the third phase of Buds. By the time Adam and the 30 remaining students of Class 227 headed to San Clemente Island, 75 miles off the coast of San Diego, for some of the last weeks of their training, he had learned the rudimentary skills of a combat diver. Now the focus was land warfare. Physically, Adam was in the best shape of his life, having completed the obstacle course in 10 minutes, the 4-mile run in boots in less than 30 minutes, and the 2-mile ocean swim with fins in less than 75 minutes. He had also finished a grueling 14-mile run without stopping, and a 5.5-mile ocean swim. Even though instructors never allowed students to slack off, during third phase they were particularly vigilant because of the use of explosives and live ammunition. Students also learned more advanced patrolling tactics and how to plan and execute realistic missions, firing upon target buildings, calling in close air support, and clearing buildings of the enemy. The men remaining had proven they weren't going to quit. Now they had to remain focused and uninjured for one last phase. One of 227's first training days on the island took the class on a conditioning jog up a steep, rocky rise. At the top, the instructor allowed the men to catch their breath before leading them to a small, nearly vertical cliff that dropped down onto another steep, rocky slope. He pointed out a landmark at the bottom of this ankle-twisting obstacle course. "Get down to that as fast as you can," he told them, "then run back up. Pays to be a winner," he added. Immediately, the men began to carefully sideslip and shuffle down the slope, which was about 45 degrees, a big giant rock face, says Austin, who was just a few steps into his descent when Adam passed him. Adam was sprinting 100 miles an hour. He made it about halfway, his gangly legs and arms just flying, till he lost control and started somersaulting, 3 or 4 big flips, crushing him each time on the rocks. Somehow he ended up on his feet, ran to the end, and then sprinted back up. He was back on top before most of us were at the bottom. Everything Adam did was a sprint. He didn't know how to hold back. He cared more about his performance and his reputation than his physical body. The baby was due February 18th, 2000. Scheduled to return home from the island on January 31st, Adam received permission to check in with Kelly the week before.
"Everything's fine. It's all good," Kelly told him. "What's going on with you?"
"Good," Adam said, but there was a huge weapons practical test that coming Wednesday that had him stressed. Kelly never let on to Adam that she had been on mandatory bed rest for the past few days due to complications with the pregnancy. Preeclampsia and intrauterine growth restriction, both of which are potentially dangerous and even fatal for mother and baby. The morning after she talked with Adam, she headed to a doctor's appointment for her weekly checkup. "We need to deliver this baby today," the doctor said upon examining her. When Kelly gave Adam's parents the news, Janice took the next flight to San Diego, arriving at midnight. By then, Kelly was already in induced labor and suffering from a literally blinding headache from the magnesium sulfate she'd received to lower her blood pressure. After 18 hours of painful labor, through which Kelly couldn't see much more than shapes and blurs, Nathan Cole Brown was born on Wednesday, January 26th, all 4 pounds, 8 ounces of him. While in recovery, Kelly called the Buds compound to let them know that Adam Brown was the father of a healthy baby boy. "But do not tell him until after he completes the weapons practical this afternoon," she told the instructor who answered the phone. "Yes, ma'am," he replied. "Understood." On San Clemente Island, Adam waited nervously for the weapons practical to begin, hoping he wouldn't get called on first. "Brown," the instructor broke the silence. "You're up." Adam stepped up to the carbine and handgun laid out on a table. When the timer began, he first cleared a jam in each weapon, then began disassembling and reassembling each weapon while the instructors peppered him with questions. "What is the effective firing range of this weapon, Brown? What is the purpose of that mechanism, Brown? What caliber is the ammunition used in that gun, Brown?" Answering in stride, Adam reassembled both weapons. "Done," he said, clicking the final part into place and raising his hands off the table. "Good job, Brown. Good job. Now, go over to the office and call your wife at this number." The instructor handed him a piece of paper. "She's just had a baby. You're a dad. Congratulations." At the news, Adam sprinted to the phone. "Are you okay?" he asked Kelly. "Nathan is all right?" "Yes," said Kelly, sounding tired but happy. "He's healthy. He's little. But your mama is here, and she said you were little too, and that never slowed you down." "My mom's there?" "She's staying for graduation, so you get done. Finish up and come meet your baby boy." The ocean swell picked up and waves started pounding the island, making the conclusion of Phase 3 particularly brutal for Class 227. In one exercise, as students swam through the surf zone with their rucksacks, a wave hammered Christian when he attempted to pull on a fin, and he ended up with a broken ankle. He struck a deal that he could graduate from Buds if he pushed through the final exercises on crutches. Before the other students headed back to Coronado and Christian headed into surgery, they celebrated their last day on the island with a barbecue, during which the commanding officer followed tradition by telling them that this was only the beginning of their training. "You'll train for the rest of your careers," he said. "And if you're lucky, you'll get a chance to serve your country and do the real thing." Kelly and Nathan were released from the hospital and able to drive to the Buds compound with Janice when Adam returned from San Clemente Island. The family's reunion was shared by a throng of Adam's classmates, who slapped the new father on the back when Kelly presented him with his swaddled baby boy.
"He's so little," said Adam, holding the newborn awkwardly.
The baby's head flopped to one side and Janice jumped forward.
"Don't drop him," she said, guiding Adam's hand to support his son's neck.
That evening, Nathan fell asleep cradled in Adam's arms as he sat on the couch of the Browns' El Cajon home.
"It's a miracle," he kept saying. "I can't believe it."
Kelly cuddled up beside Adam, and together they stared at Nathan as he slept, mesmerized. At Bud's graduation a week later, Adam was one of only 26 men left, including Austin and Christian, fresh out of surgery. It was an especially moving occasion for the Brown family, including Sean and his wife Tina, and Manda and her husband Jeremy, as they watched proudly. "We knew something extra about Adam," says Sean. "Nobody there realized what else Adam had been through just to get in the Navy." During training, an instructor had told the men that they would become like brothers, closer than any friends in high school or college. He had encouraged them to embrace that brotherhood and find strength in it, but to never, ever forsake the importance of family. Now, after hugging and thanking every member of his family for having faith in him, Adam presented to his father the Bible that Chaplain Freiberg had given him after Hell Week. Inside the cover, on the page opposite the chaplain's note, Adam had written, "Dad, thanks for instilling in me all that I have. Thanks for believing in me even when I didn't believe in myself. God couldn't have given me a better example of who I want to be in life. If I become half of the man you are, I'll be happy of who I am. I wish I could express in words the respect I have for you. I think you're the greatest dad ever. Thanks for being so positive in my life."
Chapter 10. A Seal is Born. The doctor who reconstructed Christian Taylor's ankle told him the injury was a game changer. "He told me I'd never be able to do the job," says Christian. "Never be able to jump out of planes or handle the pounding I'd take as a SEAL. But I knew I could. I just had to get some rehab and suck it up." "When they told us what SEAL teams we were going to go to, there were two things I wanted," he continues. "One was to go to the East Coast, and the other was to not be on the same team as Adam. I heard my name and Team 4, which was perfect, East Coast team. Then they said, 'Adam Brown, Team 4. And I just shook my head. Still annoyed that he'd been medically rolled from class 226 into 227, Christian put the blame for his stress fractures not on the instructors or the curriculum of BUDS, but on Adam. Adam was the only person to ever push him so hard his body had failed. If they were on the same team, that rivalry was sure to continue. And frankly, he didn't know if he could maintain the pace. These were some of the thoughts Christian mulled over as he convalesced in Coronado, while Adam, Austin, who was also assigned to SEAL Team 4, and most of the other graduates headed to Fort Benning, Georgia, for 3 weeks of airborne training before checking in at their respective teams. Kelly returned to Arkansas with Nathan, planning to bounce back and forth between the Browns' home in Hot Springs and her father's home in Little Rock. 1 week into airborne training, however, Adam called. "Itty bitty," he said. "Everything is okay, but it's calling my name." "My heart sank when he said that," says Kelly. Adam had been drug-free for 1 year and 7 months, but she'd done her research and learned that relapse was still extremely likely. For Adam, the trigger was a glance at a gas station from a man he instantly knew was a dealer. A suggestive look that said, "You need something?"
"You have come too far," Kelly told him. "You are not going to throw all this away. You need to be strong. We've got a family now."
"I know," said Adam.
"We're coming out," she said. "Think about where we can stay. And I need to talk to Austin. Is he there?"
When Adam had filled Austin in on his past, Kelly wasn't so sure it was a good idea, thinking word would get around that Adam was a recovering addict and had been in jail, which couldn't help his reputation in a community where reputation was everything. But now Austin reassured her that he was keeping an eye on Adam and urging him to be careful about whom he shared his story with. Kelly was thankful and relieved that Adam had someone close by watching out for him.
"You're a good friend," she said to Austin before hanging up.
Next, Kelly informed her father, who had planned to drive with her to Fort Benning in a couple of weeks, that there'd been a change of plans.
"Something came up with Adam's training," she said. "We need to leave sooner."
"When?"
"I'll get packing now. Can we leave tomorrow?"
2 days later, Kelly's father helped her and Nathan move into a one-room vacation cabin that Adam had found on the base. Now, when Adam wasn't in class, in an airplane, or jumping out of one, he was with his family.
"I put Nathan in his arms every chance I got," says Kelly. "While he was studying, when we ate dinner, I knew holding Nathan made him strong, reminded him he was a father, and why he couldn't give in."
After Adam earned his parachute jump wings, the three drove east to Virginia Beach, where they rented an apartment not far from the Naval Amphibious Base at Little Creek. the East Coast home of Naval Special Warfare Group 2. On the morning of March 27, 2000, just after Nathan turned 2 months old, Adam checked in at the SEAL Team 4 headquarters, a single-story building within a fenced compound at the water's edge of the base. Wearing the required dress whites, Adam approached the main reception area, or quarterdeck, of the ship, what all buildings in the Navy are considered, sticking out like a sore thumb and eliciting scornful comments from the team guys dressed in camis or PT shorts and T-shirts. "Get your sunglasses, boys," announced one SEAL, shielding his eyes. "There's something bright white and stupid coming on board." The ridicule began another rite of passage for the new guys, one in which their SEAL trident pins were prominently displayed in a glass case inside the entrance to the quarterdeck, a continual reminder that they were not yet official U.S. Navy SEALs. Established in late 1970, the Naval Special Warfare Trident signifies a SEAL's official membership in this exclusive fraternity. The coveted insignia recognizes those who have completed BUDS training, made it through a 6 to 9 month probationary period, and passed advanced SEAL tactical training. Only then are SEALs authorized to wear the trident, as a gold pin on dress uniforms and an embroidered patch on camis. There are four components to the trident: the anchor, symbolizing the Navy; the trident, which represents the SEAL's historical ties to the sea; the cocked pistol, a reminder of SEAL's capabilities on land and their constant state of readiness; and the eagle, which, in addition to being the national emblem of freedom, symbolizes the SEAL's ability to insert from the air. The eagle's head is traditionally held high, but on the trident, its head is lowered, signifying that a true warrior's strength comes from humility. The day after Adam checked in, Austin joined Team 4 and was permitted to wear his trident, briefly. A Master Chief pulled it out of the case and pinned it to the wrong side of a black wool vest that the Chief made Austin pull over his dress whites. Looking ridiculous, Austin then had to walk the halls of the building receiving jeers from the established members of SEAL Team 4. Every new guy was at the mercy of whoever happened to be around when he checked in, and endured anything from catcalls about his dress whites to getting his trident painted blue, the same color as inert training munition, the derision being that until he was fully trained, that's exactly how he would be regarded: inert, harmless, useless. So began the probation period for Adam and his classmates from Class 227. They would go through SEAL Tactical Training, STT, the apprentice to journeyman stage in learning and absorbing the tactical aspects of the SEAL trade and honing basic warfighting skills. Land warfare, combat swimming, land navigation, weapons skills, and patrolling. At the end of STT, they would have to take a 3-day final exam with both written and oral aspects. Those who passed would be platooned up, assigned to one of 12 platoons on Team 4, each comprising 16 men, 2 officers, a chief petty officer, and 13 enlisted. Then, after a punishing ocean swim, they would be presented with their trident and deemed SEALs by their brethren. The next East Coast STT course wasn't set to begin until June, so in the meantime, the mission of the new guys was to support the Team 4 platoons. Their ships needed upkeep, floors mopped, walls painted, windows washed, trash taken out. In his first week at Team 4, Adam scrubbed garbage cans, unclogged the toilet a few times, and reorganized a storage closet. But he also sat in on a planning meeting for a training exercise, joined a platoon at the firing range, and absorbed the peripheral chatter that gave shape and purpose to the job. "He attacked whatever task he was given," says a Team 4 Master Chief. Sometimes we'd give the new guys BS tasks, like go do a backflip off the dock. Some guys rolled their eyes, said okay, and then did whatever it was at half speed, knowing they were getting messed with. But Adam ran down to that dock like he was on an op. No questions, no hesitation. Like, there must be a higher purpose that I'm doing this backflip with all my clothes on into the ocean. He was can-do from day one. During his second week, Adam was chosen to support a platoon's training dive. In the dark of night, Adam and five SEALs, all in full dive gear, boarded an inflatable boat and paddled across the Little Creek Inlet on the southern shore of Chesapeake Bay to a training area. There they would place limpet mines, magnetic naval explosives named for their superficial similarity to the limpet mollusk, and used since the early 1900s to destroy enemy ships, piers, and bridges. While the SEALs readied for the dive, Adam slid his brand-new SEAL pup knife out of its sheath and attempted to cut through the heavy-duty plastic zip tie holding a dive buoy against the boat. The tie held fast, so with the blade facing him, he used his full might to pull up. The blade cut through the tie, then continued up to Adam's face, jabbing him above his nose, right between his eyes.
"Oh, man,"
Adam said, pinching the deep gouge to stop the blood pouring from the wound. When he looked up, the SEALs were shocked to see blood dripping off the end of his nose and streaming down his cheeks. "What the hell happened?" one said. With his free arm, Adam waved off their attempts to get a closer look. They were only a half hour into a four-hour training operation that he didn't want aborted, especially because of him.
"Hey, I'm good.
I'm okay," he said, squeezing the wound while blood trickled out. The SEALs gaped at him.
"Carry on," he said. "Let's do this."
Adam remained in the boat the 2 hours it took to place the mines. Then the team leader, who because of Adam's injury had no intention of forcing Adam to retrieve them, jokingly said, "Okay, Brown, go get the mines." He gestured with a thumb at the cold black water. Without hesitation, Adam flipped backward overboard, the knife wound pouring blood again as he donned his mask and submerged. When he resurfaced, lugging a mine that he tossed into the boat, his mask was a quarter full of blood. He emptied the blood and dived again. A SEAL started humming the theme from the movie Jaws while the team tracked Adam's underwater movement by watching his marker buoy travel from the boat to the bridge pylons and back. On his final trip, the buoy started heading out to sea, the opposite direction from the remaining mine. Assuming that Adam was either visually disoriented from blood in his mask or mentally disoriented from loss of blood, they yanked on the line and tried to redirect him to the boat. But, determined to get the job done, Adam refused, instead redirecting himself to the mine, retrieving it, and only then returning to the boat. When he reached for an oar to help paddle back to shore, a SEAL told him to stand down. "We'll make it to shore, Brown," he said. "You just keep pressure on that wound and try not to bleed to death." The following morning, more than 100 SEALs from Team 4 stood at quarters. The once-a-week gathering where all platoons not deployed or training elsewhere stand in formation and receive official information from the Master Chiefs. It's also a time for the skipper, at the time Captain Pete Van Hooser, to address the entire team, sometimes giving out awards or highlighting a dumb new guy mistake, says Austin, who stood beside Adam that day. The Master Chief from the platoon Adam had supported the night before took this opportunity to address some very serious concerns. He proceeded to give a Cub Scout-level refresher on knife safety. Never pull the business end of a knife toward your body, especially not toward your face. The men laughed as Adam, stitched up and bandaged, was presented with a rubber knife and a nickname, Blade. Although Adam had been embarrassed and berated himself the night before, he laughed at the nickname. In spite of the rookie blunder, he left a solid impression, says Austin. Everybody knew Adam Brown was not going to let anybody take up his slack, even if he was bleeding. For long days and longer nights, the SEALs on Team 4 worked the new guys, integrating them, as Adam had been on the diving exercise, and hammering them with information they must remember. "I hope you're taking notes," was a common admonishment as they jumped from task to task. "It was like drinking water through a fire hose," explains Christian, who had cut short his rehabilitation and joined the team in late April, pins still in his ankle. At the beginning of May, Christian and Adam were tasked with supporting an operational readiness exercise, ORE, the final exam for a SEAL platoon after its 12-month workup. Intensive, cumulative training exercises that prepare them for deployment into the real world. The ORE consists of a series of war games in which the platoon is pitted against an opposing force of enemy soldiers attempting to thwart its mission. The cadre of instructors orchestrating this particular ORE employed Adam and Christian to role-play as enemy patrolling the area where an American pilot had gone down. Their job was to spot members of the platoon being tested, whose mission was to locate and rescue the pilot undetected.
"I'll drive,"
Adam said to Christian, as soon as they were handed the keys to a pickup truck and told where to go. "He peeled out, literally burned rubber," says Christian, "then drove like a maniac, drifting around corners, hitting potholes. I thought he was being an ass, trying to scare me, see if I'd tell him to slow down. I just tightened my seatbelt and held on. I was not going to give in." On the third day of the ORE, Adam and Christian had the afternoon off. In their 9 months of buds together, they had done little more than compete, never once sitting down to have a conversation. "We were sitting on a pier watching this guy fishing," says Christian. "No rivalry, nobody yelling at us. For the first time we were relaxed, so we talked. Adam opened up and showed me all the demons from his past. How messed up he'd been on drugs, gone to jail, how his wife would go looking for him in crack houses, and how becoming a SEAL wasn't a dream for him. It had been his last hope. I was awestruck, but I was glad to know he had demons too, because I sure as hell did. Weaknesses make people real, and he let me know his. And that took serious trust. If the wrong people got wind of his past, that could have been bad for him. Something in him trusted me, and so I shared my demons with him, the bad things I'd done in my life. We talked until the sun went down, and when we walked away from that pier, I thought, this guy is good to go. I could trust him completely. Later that night, they were awakened by the Master Chief running the ORE. A large, rigid-hulled inflatable boat, RHIB, being used in the exercise, had run aground on a sandbar during a beach landing. It was now Adam and Christian's job to rescue it, an important task for a SEAL and unheard of for new guys. "It was our first mission ever," says Christian, "and the last thing the Master Chief told us was, 'You better not effing fail.'" They sped an hour north to a Coast Guard base where they jumped aboard a waiting towboat for the 2-hour ride to the marooned boat. As they approached the stranded vessel, Adam readied the tow rope. Before the anchor dropped, he was in the water with the rope, swimming toward the inflatable. That's when Christian realized that Adam's crazy driving wasn't a personal affront. "It was just Adam's speed," he says. "Everything he did was fast and furious." Christian joined Adam in the water while a couple of SEALs who had been left on board the marooned boat monitored their progress, offering little more help than, "Get it done." "We free-dove, masks only, and were danger close to the intakes of revved-up jet engines," says Christian, describing conditions around the RHIB. "There were currents, and we had to fix and refix lines while the towboat pulled. We had to look out for each other, especially when we were clearing the intakes. Massive suction going on, the water all churned up. But we got the engines running and got it off that sandbar. For the first time, we weren't competing with each other. We were working together as a team." When Adam began SEAL tactical training in June, Nathan was a little over 4 months old, and his parents had weathered the basic training of their new careers and were now honing their skills as warrior and mother. While Adam mastered land navigation through the woods, Kelly memorized grocery store aisles for quick in-and-out missions. As he skillfully blew up an enemy bunker, she deftly changed a blown-out diaper. He evaded a mock enemy, while she dodged projectile vomit. As STT progressed, the training and subsequent real-world scenarios became more complicated for both of the Browns. In the STT field classroom, "You've patrolled for 5 hours through enemy-held terrain, and your platoon has remained undetected. The instructor describes a scenario to Adam and his teammates during the patrolling phase of advanced land warfare training. Boom! The guy in front of you hits a booby trap. His lower leg is blown off. He's screaming, hemorrhaging blood. And guess what? There's an enemy observation post right there, and they open up with heavy machine gun fire. What's your first priority? What are you going to do? Come on, your buddy is dying. You're under attack. There are enemy reinforcements heading our way. What's the call? In the Browns' small apartment on base, Nathan has his first cold and is awake most of the night. Kelly needs to go shopping because there is no food in the house and only 4 diapers. On the drive to the store, Nathan finally falls asleep and snoozes in his car seat. With Nathan still sleeping, Kelly maneuvers the shopping cart through crowds rushing from aisle to aisle, throwing in milk and frozen foods at the very end. She rushes to the front of the store only to find long lines at the 2 open registers. Boom! A little old lady bumps her cart into Kelly and apologizes, but Kelly's focus is on Nathan's eyelids. They open and the hungry baby starts to cry, then scream. Everybody around watches, obviously annoyed, as she picks him up. And here comes the snot. Quick rummage through the purse. No tissues. The frozen stuff in the cart is melting. There is no way she's going to breastfeed Nathan standing in a line that she estimates will take 15 minutes to get through. In the field. Come on, guys, the instructor yells. Your buddy is bleeding out and you've got another casualty. What's the order? In the grocery store, Kelly starts to cry. She surrenders, lifts the car seat from the shopping cart, and runs to her car. By the end of STT, 3 months later, Kelly had learned a lot about what it meant to be a Navy SEAL's wife. In the first 7 months of Nathan's life, Adam had been with his son only a handful of days. His social life outside the Navy was an extension of the friendships he'd forged within. So it worked out well that Kelly clicked with Christian's wife, Becky, soon to be a new mom herself, and Heidi Ames, the girlfriend of an officer on Team 4 named Paul Jacobs. As is standard in the military community, the women spent time together and became each other's support group while the boys trained. Paul, a buddy of Adam's from Class 226, who had sailed through Bud's training without getting rolled, attributed much of his physical endurance and mental focus to being a high school and college wrestler, the same thing Adam said about football. And, of course, Adam would not be outdone when the two waxed poetic about their backgrounds. He claimed that his 2-a-day summer football conditioning practices in the sweltering humidity of the South rivaled Paul's steam room wrestling practices. This segued into how much better a state Arkansas was than California, where Paul was from. You got beaches, we got lakes, Adam would say. California has to import its drinking water, but Arkansas doesn't have to import anything. We could put a bubble over the entire state and we'd be just fine. We have every natural resource. You name it, we have it. Or grow it. Fruits, vegetables. We've even got catfish farms. The soil in Arkansas, the dirt, is richer in minerals. You scoop up a handful, it looks like coffee grounds. His Arkansas bubble theory, its roots in an 8th grade history class, would lead back to football and the best high school team in Arkansas, the Lake Hamilton Wolves, then to the best college football team in the country, the University of Arkansas Razorbacks, which always included a rousing rendition of the university's hog call. Whoopee! Suey! You didn't want to get him started about Arkansas, says Paul. Everybody knew where Adam Brown was from. He had more pride in his home state than anybody. While all of Adam's teammates knew he was from Arkansas, they also knew Paul was a wrestler, due to his standing bet during STT, that he could pin anybody in 30 seconds or less. Says Christian, I thought Adam was going soft when he wasn't the first to take the challenge. But Adam wasn't going soft. He was analyzing the problem, and Paul was a big problem. In college, he'd wrestled in the 184-pound weight class, and now, after Bud's, he was in the best shape of his life. Officers, enlisted men, even some of the cadre instructors gave it a go, every one of them ending up flat on their backs and pinned in under 30 seconds. After a few weeks of this, a crowd gathered on a grassy field to watch Adam finally face off against Paul. At the count of three, a designated timekeeper hit his stopwatch, and Adam turned and sprinted, much to the surprise of Paul and the spectators, who started cracking up as they cheered him on. He made it about 30 yards before Paul tackled him, flipped him over, and pinned him. In 35 seconds. "He was the only guy who ever made it past 30, says Paul. "And I respected him for it. He beat me. And I learned something about Adam that day. He wasn't only tough. He was smart." On September 5th, Adam, along with Austin, Paul, and an expanding list of fellow SEALs who had become brothers-in-arms, went through a timed series of pass-or-fail tests based on what they'd learned in advanced SEAL tactical training. Stations were set up for map reading, weapons handling and maintenance, communications, radio drills, medical procedures, and other skills. Then each man except Christian, Becky was in the hospital having a baby, stood before the Trident board for the final oral exam. When Adam's turn came, his superiors presented him with the same earlier scenario of a patrol hitting a booby trap and coming under heavy machine gun fire. He was ready. "First thing to do, sir, is win the fight." Adam proceeded to give a rundown on procedure. Returning fire is the first priority, then maneuvering against the enemy while the team leader calls for close air support and casualty evacuation. If the downed man is conscious, he is doing self-aid and putting a tourniquet on his leg, but most likely he is unconscious. The fight must be won before helping the downed man. Self-aid, buddy aid, and then corpsman aid. As soon as a SEAL can be spared from the fight, he will treat the downed man. The chiefs of SEAL Team 4 passed Adam, evaluating him as one of the hardest workers, a role model, and a top performer. "I love what I do."